welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski, and I've got some business to take care of before I introduce my first guest today. One thing I wanted to mention was an update on a story I did last week regarding Clotilde Mack, the 85-year-old elderly woman from New Orleans who was trapped in her home. She was on our show for 2 hours, discussed her situation. She was trapped for 10 days, survived on 2 cans of string beans and 7 small bottles of water, an unbelievable story, without her medication. Now she's housed in some halfway house in Tennessee, wants to get home, and FEMA is her biggest obstacle. Her house is in a little bit of disrepair. However, she feels she can go back and start putting her life in order. She doesn't want to stay in this halfway house. And we discussed this whole plight, had the mayor of Greene County get on also last week, and promise that they would get this trailer to her on her property in New Orleans by Christmas. And we're going to see if they follow up on that. I also called Senator Landry's office to make sure this happens. And we're going to not forget about Clotilde Mack. And that was great to have her on the show. But I wanted to update one of our listeners, Joan Rendell, emailed me and said that she is going to help financially with Miss Mack. So I'm going to forward that off to her. That's really encouraging. And there's been a few emails like that. So we're going to make sure Miss Mack gets home for Christmas. The other part of the other story I wanted to update was when we had Pat, our ARCESD, RC on our program last week. He's dying from cancer from working at the World Trade Center. This is an issue that is very important. The government lied to many of those workers. There are 2 people have already been died. Many others are ill with respiratory problems. Pat RC was on our program last week and told us about his situation. Basically, he is dying from cancer. It's been found to be related to the toxins at the World Trade Center. Pat worked there for at least, he worked probably longer than most volunteers there. He worked almost past Christmas and 12 hours a day. And about 8 months after that, he came down ill. And from a man of 6'3", 225 pounds, he deteriorated to 125 pounds. He's now living at his mother's house in Florida. And we're going to keep close tabs to Pat. And I want to thank Nick Busey, one of our listeners, for emailing me regarding this. And I've also had a number of people who are trying to help Pat, so thanks for that. Put him in contact with him. He doesn't have a website. So thank you very much for that. Don't forget about him. You can catch both of my articles on these people at www.arcticbeacon.com. And we've got to come to assistance of these of our fellow Americans, because I tell you something, the government's turning a cold cheek to a lot of us. But anyway, I want to thank Nick Busey, who said today that he's holding a documentary showing a film about 9/11 called Loose Change. And afterwards, he will have a public reading of my article about Pat RC, and then we'll collect donations and then send them to Pat. And I really appreciate that. So, Nick, if you're out there, thank you. And we'll keep in touch regarding that showing. But anyway, let me get to one thing here. I'm going to get back to my guest. I'll introduce him after the break. We've got a lot more 9/11 miraculous evidence coming out again. I've been following this story and had an opportunity again to talk to some more of the flight families who have been relatively silent and very strangely all agreeing with the government story. In stark contrast to many of the families who have lost people at Ground Zero, but I also uncovered some more miraculous 9/11 evidence that's coming forward, stuff that you wouldn't imagine would survive a towering inferno like the World Trade Center, but it did, and you can read that story, which will be coming out on my website at www.arcticbeacon.com. We'll be back in 3 minutes with my special guest, Neela Sagadevan. He's an author, aeronautical engineer. We've got some fascinating things to talk about, so come back on the Investigative Journal in 3 minutes. Okay, we're back for our first segment here on the Investigative Journal. I'm not going to waste any time. We've got some important information to talk about. I have Neela Sagadevan on my program today. He's with us. He's an author, wrote a book called War Paint of the Gods, a fascinating a look at what is really God's religion, and why have there been so many wars in the name of God? It's a fascinating topic. We're going to discuss that. But there's another part of Neela's life that I wanted to get into. He's a 9/11 researcher. He's an aeronautical engineer, a pilot, and he specializes in aerodynamics, and he's got some interesting takes on the Pentagon pilots and all of the mystery surrounding could those 19 Arab hijackers actually commandeer those airplanes. And he's got some fascinating information we'll get into with Neil. I just wanted to mention, though, that he is also a member of 9/11, reopen911.org. It's a group funded by philanthropist Jimmy Walter, who is trying to get at the truth of 9/11, spending his hard-earned money in ways that a lot of people are benefiting, and that one is the American people to try to get at the truth. Neil, are you with us today?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. You sound perfect. I know you're in sunny California, and it's nice to have you on the Investigative Journal. I guess, you know what, why don't we start out with 9/11? It's an issue that is always on the tip of my tongue every day. I hope you heard, and I wanted to mention before we got into your specialty, and that's aerodynamics, if you didn't hear, I mentioned at the top of the hour, top of the show, a story I did about Pat Arce, who is a 9/11 hero, a worker at 9/11, who is dying of cancer. And I know reopen911.org, a group that you're involved in, is very, very involved in getting out the truth about the EPA lying to the workers at 9/11. Can you tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing there?
Well, I'm sorry I can't address that, Greg, because I really am not familiar with that aspect of it.
Okay. I just thought you may be because it was on your website. So let's get right into your specialty, and that's aerodynamics. Now, tell us first, Neela. You're a pilot. You're an aeronautical engineer. Tell us first how you got involved in 9/11 and how you came up with some of these conclusions that possibly these pilots couldn't commandeer these airplanes.
Well, I, like millions of others, I suppose, we believed the official story, whatever was told to us. And about 3 years later, actually it was September of last year, when someone took me to a website, kicking and screaming, saying, you got to go see this.
Right.
And I put on my engineer and pilot's hat, watched this thing for about a minute and said, this is absurd. This simply couldn't have happened. And I actually got involved because I made an attempt to try and disprove this. And the deeper I dug, the more convinced I became.
Now, what were you watching on the video?
The Pentagon strike.
Okay.
I think the site was called Hunt the Boeing or something similar to that. It's a European site. And
okay.
It was about, where's his Boeing 757? So that's how my journey began.
And so basically it started with you trying to disprove the theory, and what occurred? Obviously you had difficulty.
None of it made sense. But before I get into the aerodynamics of it, Greg, I'd like to talk about some of the more basic aspects of this whole thing, the hijackers themselves.
These so-called
19 hijackers. Well, I am in possession of the flight manifests of all four aircraft. And guess what? There's not one Arab name on any one of them. None on the United Airlines manifest, none on Americans. Now, obviously, the first question is, how did these guys get on board? So that's a question that hasn't been answered yet. Because, I mean, if you look at, if you ask any airline captain, they won't leave the ground. They'd have to reconcile the manifest with the seat count, and if the people aren't there, or if you've got too many people on board, we'd have to find out why before an aircraft can take off. So how did these 19 guys get on board? Another thing is we've constantly been shown these videos of the security camera zooming in on Mohammed Atta. I mean, that thing has been doctored. There's no doubt. Where in the world do you find a security camera that, of its own volition, will zoom in on one individual and follow him around to the exclusion of everyone else around him?
And that was in Portland, Maine, I believe.
That's correct.
That was
Portland, Maine.
You know, one interesting fact, I interviewed a ticket taker at Portland, Maine. His name was Mr. Tui, who actually talked to the FBI, said he saw Mohammed Atta and another gentleman at his counter. Within 30 seconds, he had to go through that video camera, and basically he said they weren't wearing the same clothes that they were shown on that camera. So there was some really interesting things there. But go ahead.
Well, so much for the hijackers. Now, when you let's talk about just a Pentagon strike, which is American Airlines flight.
You know, one thing can I mention about the security? I might add also that the security tapes are basic, were never released for any of the passengers getting on board any of the four planes, which is very strange because the security cameras are pretty they're on all the time, but no one's ever seen security cameras of the passengers actually getting on the respective flights.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Go ahead, Neela.
Well, let's focus just on Flight 77,
right.
The airliner that allegedly struck the Pentagon. I say allegedly because I'm convinced that it was not a 757. It
okay.
was an aircraft of sorts, but certainly not a Boeing 757. But nonetheless, here we have an aircraft flying southeast at 35,000 feet over the Ohio-Kentucky border. And we have Mr. Honeyhan Jur in seat 1B up front, who supposedly took control of this aircraft. You know, I got to say something about Honeyhan Jur. I've spoken with two of his flight instructors. This guy could not solo a Cessna 150. Now, a Cessna 150 is the smallest airplane in Cessna's fleet. It's a little single-engine two-seat trainer. And what I mean by solo, in case some of your listeners are not familiar with the term, is a pilot's first time out without anyone else in the cockpit with him. It's the most simple, most fundamental flying exercise one can engage in. You're seated inside the aircraft, you hit the power, you take off, make a couple of 90-degree turns, maximum altitude of around 900 to 1,000 feet, come back and land. One.
You're saying this alleged hijacker, Honeyhan Jur, could not solo 150.
He could not solo. In fact, one of his flight instructors, and I quote him, he said, the man could not fly at all. Another one of his flight instructors said he didn't even know how an automobile engine worked. He was completely out of the loop. Another one said his attention span was zero. So here we have Honeyhan Jur in seat 1B. I forget the exact seat number. I believe it was 1B. He barges into the cockpit, and who do we have in control? It's Captain Charles Burlingame. Burlingame is a 185-pound ex-Vietnam fighter jock. 100 combat missions in Nam. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah.
Let's say, he's supposed to have taken this guy out of the box cutter. And let's not forget his co-pilot, David Chabot. This guy is another 180-pounder. And you're talking about a very cramped cockpit. I don't know how many of you people have been on a commercial airline cockpit, but it's not the easiest place to get into and out of. And people who know Burlingame say that the first thing he would have done was snap roll that airplane, put it on his back, Honeyhan would have hit the deck and broken his neck. Easiest
right.
thing to do.
Huh.
He does nothing.
Interesting.
He does nothing. And then Honeyhan is supposed to have cut this guy's throat, or heaven knows what he did. Now he's got to drag these two huge bodies out of this tight cockpit before he can even get in. Now, if he were to do that, the control yoke, if it is moved very aggressively, that would disengage the autopilot. So that didn't happen, because if it did, there would have been pandemonium with the airplane. But even that didn't occur. So magically, Honeyhan finds himself sitting in the cockpit, in, let's say, in Burlingame's seat. Yeah, people seem to think that all you need to do is learn how to fly an airplane in a simulator, and they think flight simulators are these things you see in amusement arcades. Well, they're really not. They're a lot more complicated than that. A real flight simulator is very much like a real airplane, and they're configured to match the control consoles and the cockpit configuration of the particular aircraft they represent. So even if Honeyhan had trained in a simulator, you've got to understand the whole idea about this. You can move your rudder pedals, you can push and pull on your yoke, you can wallow around in the sky, but that's not flying. That's just ambling along doing something in the sky. What non-pilots don't understand is you first got to find your target, and that requires electronic navigation skills, typically what's called IFR, instrument flight rules. Now, let's say Honeyhan sits in this cockpit, 35,000 feet, heading southeast, cloud cover beneath him. He can't see it. He could as well have been flying over Tokyo or Buenos Aires. He wouldn't have a clue where on the planet he was. The instruments in front of him would make absolutely no sense. Nothing. So now we've got to get this guy who couldn't go around the patch in a Cessna 150. He's going to turn this 100-ton airliner around and go back to Washington, D.C. He hasn't a clue where he is. Now, a funny thing happens here. All of a sudden, NORAD radar and all FAA radar contact is lost with Flight 77 over the Ohio-Kentucky border. There is absolutely no return radar track of this airplane heading back to Washington, D.C. So that's something that has to be solved. But let's say that Hanjour managed to put this aircraft into a stealth mode. Now, he gets back over Washington, D.C. How he found D.C., as I said, is yet to be determined.
Now, let's say he... Okay, just put us in that cockpit. Hanjour, like you said, mysteriously takes over. What is he confronted with? I mean, if he has no idea, how can he turn that plane around? I mean, I'm just thinking of myself. I have no airplane experience outside of maybe being up in a small plane and a friend of mine several times giving me the stick. Tell me, after the break, how he could possibly turn this around if he was just lucky. We'll
sure.
be back with Neela Sagadevan, and he's an aeronautical engineer, giving us a fascinating view of what it would be like to turn around that Pentagon plane with no pilot experience on the Investigative Journal. 23 minutes after the hour on the Investigative Journal, I'm talking to Neela Sagadevan regarding the strange 9/11 flights. Neela, I guess at the break I was cut off. Oh, and by the way, before we get through with this hour, make sure I can talk about your book a little. I'm going to squeeze in a few minutes about your book. Neela's written a book called War Paint of the Gods, and we want to discuss that a few minutes before the hour is over. But Neela, tell us, you know, given this guy, give this hijacker the benefit of the doubt, could he be lucky and turn that thing around?
Okay, you asked me about the cockpit. I mean, this guy
right.
would be looking at a most bewildering array of instruments. In his little Cessna 150, he would have found some basic, very basic instrument, like an airspeed indicator, a rate of climb indicator, and so forth, artificial horizon, little, tiny, little analog instruments. Here, he's faced with six huge CRTs, multi-mode CRTs. They could have been in any mode. He wouldn't have had a clue. But let's say he even overcomes this huge hurdle and flies back to Washington, D.C. in stealth mode with no radar seeing him. When he gets above Washington, D.C., he makes two incredible maneuvers. He makes two descending turns at 360 degrees a minute, high-rate turns. I challenge any airline pilot to pull this off, while descending at 3,500 feet per minute. This is an incredible maneuver. It was so incredible, one of the air traffic controllers in Dallas, her name's Daniel O'Brien, and I'm going to quote Daniel, or Danielle, it is, it's a lady. The speed, the maneuverability, the way that he turned... We all thought, all of us in the radar room, all of us experienced air traffic controllers, that that was a military aircraft. I mean, it was impossible for this guy to have pulled this thing off in a Boeing 757, but let's say he does even that. Guess what? During the second one of his high-rate turns, he has the presence of mind to very professionally turn off his transponder. According to one of his flight instructors, the man could not even spell the word transponder. So let's give
but
him
he
the
then
benefit.
Turns it off?
Yeah, he turns it off in mid-maneuver while he's doing a 360-degree-per-minute turn and diving at 3,500 feet per minute, he turns off his transponder.
Okay, you're an experienced pilot. Put yourself in that position. You think you could have pulled that off?
And this is absurd. You know, I couldn't have. Perhaps put Chuck Yeager in the cockpit, he might have ripped the wings off doing this thing, but he couldn't have. And the amazing thing is... When he levels out at a very low altitude, where he has ground reference at this point, he sees the White House in front of him. He passes over the White House and then lines himself up with the Pentagon. But now we come into a bigger issue. Hani Hanjour is lined up with the east wing of the Pentagon. That's where all the military top brass are, Rumsfeld and all his boys, all the generals. Now, if I were a hijacker, that's the wing I'd want. But I guess our man doesn't want to hurt America's top brass. So now he executes a 270-degree turn at about 300 feet above the ground and approaches the Pentagon, its west wing. A west wing is virtually empty. There are some civilian workers inside and just a handful of personnel. And this is the only wing that was undergoing a phase, or the first phase, of a new modification, which was to make these walls, the external walls, blast-resistant. They were reinforced with Kevlar. Now, this guy, he makes his huge turn, but when he could have just crashed right into the Pentagon, he comes around, aligns himself with this one wing. And now we get into the aerodynamics of it. He approaches his wing at an altitude of about 20 feet. How do we know he comes in at 20 feet? Well, he snapped two light posts. The second one, the first one he snapped was more than half a mile out. The second one was about 300 yards out. Now, which shows us that he was on a flat trajectory. You've got to understand how big a 757 is. This thing weighs about 240,000 pounds. Two Rolls-Royce engines, RB211s, full power. This guy's doing 400 knots at 20 feet above the ground. And this is what people should understand.
Go ahead. This is important. Go ahead.
There's something called vortex turbulence, which typically spills off as two cones off the wingtips. Also, there are things called sheet vortices that come off the main planes, off the main wings. These things together create a horrendous near-tornado cyclonic force wind behind it. At 400 miles per hour, the energy in this vortex, in this combined vortex, is so powerful, it'll spin semi-trucks. It'll pick them up into the air and spin them around. It's that high energy. And this guy flies, Hani Hanjour, evidently, flies over I-35, route I-35, or I-135, I believe it was, over all the traffic. He does no damage. Besides the vortexes, you've also got the thrust, the jet blast from two Rolls-Royce engines at 100 pounds of thrust total. Just the jet blast would have ripped roofs and sent cars spinning all over the place. Nothing happens. And the final aerodynamic point I'd like to mention is something called ground effect. Ground effect is a cushion of air that is trapped between the underside of an airplane's wing and the ground. This is a high-energy cushion of air, which, the more energized it is, the more it resists an airplane's descent towards the ground. This is what you feel when you come in for a landing in an airplane, for instance. It's the buoyant sort of floating sensation that you feel before the airplane finally settles. The airplane will refuse to settle until all the power or all the drag is decayed, its airspeed is decayed, and that's the reason you throttle back. So the airspeed drag will cause the airspeed to drop, and the plane will gently float down to the ground. When you're flying fast at 400 plus knots, the air cushion is so highly energized, it is so powerful, it will not allow the airplane to come down to that level. You cannot.
Okay, let's finish that thought, Neela. Get into some other things right after this break. Hey, we're back for the last half hour with Neela Sagadevan. He's an aeronautical engineer, and folks, you've heard stories about how it was impossible for those Arab hijackers to commandeer these airplanes. Well, you're hearing from an expert and giving you the details, backing up why it's not just hearsay. This is really compelling information from someone who knows. And by the way, I'm taking some calls, 800-313-9443, if you want to add your two cents about what happened at the Pentagon. Neela, you left off at a really important point, and that was this cushion of air. It doesn't allow a jet to land when they're traveling at 20 feet at 400 knots. Tell us about this from a technical point of view.
Yeah, it's called ground effect, and it's most pronounced in aircraft with what's called a low wing loading. A low wing loading means a large airplane with a big wing. Highly wing-loaded planes, for instance, fighter aircraft and even the B-1B bomber, which are very narrow-cored, long wings, These are what I call highly wing-loaded aircraft, and these, of course, can approach the ground at very, very high speeds because they're designed to do that. But in something like a Boeing 757, you can't do... I challenge any pilot anywhere. We can bring Chuck Yeager into the formula if you'd like. Give him a Boeing 757, tell him to do 400 knots 20 feet above the ground for half a mile. Can't do. It's aerodynamically impossible. But beyond the aerodynamics, now what happened? Yeah, people also don't realize, but 20 feet altitude in an airplane as big as a 75. If you were to pick this aircraft up with its undercarriage retracted and set it down on the lawn, the Pentagon lawn, its nose would be about 20 feet above the ground. This is with the engine nacelles actually on the ground. You must understand, this airplane didn't leave a mark on the lawn. Nothing. And the first CNN reports that there was a 100-foot crater in the lawn. Pure and absolute nonsense. There was not a scratch on the grass. This guy flew in clean and made this hole. Another thing that we were repeatedly shown was the facade of the Pentagon on the east wing that had collapsed. This thing was about 65 feet wide. What you're not shown is what was there initially as soon as the plane went in. As soon as the 757 penetrated that building, the only hole there was about 16 to 17 feet in diameter. A Boeing 757's wingspan is some 140 feet. There's a 16-foot hole, and that facade stood for 33 minutes until the fire completely consumed it, and the roof caved in, and all we are shown is what happened later, this 65-foot gap, which makes it somewhat plausible that an airplane that big could have gone in. But they never show us. I have the FEMA photographs. I've spoken to the photographer.
And what? So you're telling us that initial hit was only 16 to 17 feet in diameter?
That is correct. It's the size of the entry door of a large mansion, if you can imagine.
Now, let's just say that a big 757 did hit that building. What would it look like right after?
I would imagine, you're talking about 1.5 billion foot-pounds of kinetic energy. He would have decimated a huge chunk of that wall. It certainly wouldn't have gone through a 16-foot hole. The reason it's absurd is because the two engines alone, these engines weigh around 6,000, 6,500 pounds, the Rolls-Royce engines, they are located 40 feet apart, span-wise. Each of these should have penetrated, because you're looking at tremendous amounts of kinetic energy. These two engines should have bored their own individual holes through the walls. Did not happen. So what happened to the engines? Did they suddenly contract into the fuselage and bore itself in like a drill bit? The whole thing is absurd.
Now, I'm sure throughout your investigation, you've had some critics, some people that have disagreed with you. How do they explain this? Because I'll tell you, I've talked to numerous pilots, one being a guy by the name of Russ Whittingham, who was a military pilot in Vietnam, 30 years in 737, 757s, and he concurs with you. And, in fact, you give him a little bit more technical explanation, which is very incredible to me. But what he mentioned was the same thing you did about the impossibility of this. But one point he brought up, well, I guess I want to get back to the original question, was how have people tried to defend this that you've spoken to?
I haven't come across anyone with a convincing argument. The 16-foot hole simply can't be explained because they've got to explain what happened to the two engines. They're 40 feet apart. Let's say the nose made that 15-foot hole. It's, by the way, and people don't realize, a fuselage of an airplane, a modern airplane, is simply an aluminum tube. It's a pencil. This thing is fragile. It's not going to bore through this wall. So no one can, even if they say it's a fuselage that made that hole, what happened to the two engines? Did they evaporate?
So you're saying if the 757 did hit the engines are fragile, they would have remained outside?
No, they would have bored through. They had tremendous kinetic energy. They would have torn right through. They would have made individual holes themselves.
Okay.
This is why I say if it was indeed a 757 that crashed into it, the kinetic energy spread out across this wingspan, across the span of the engines and so forth, would have taken out a massive chunk upon impact. This did not happen. Now,
right.
Greg, I'd like to take this a step further.
Go ahead. I'd love to hear this. It's fascinating.
What we now find out, you see, the Pentagon, as everyone knows, has five rings, A, B, C, D, and E. Each of these rings has two 18-foot walls, because obviously, they have light wells that separate each ring to allow light to get into these areas, but each of the rings has two walls, an inner and an outer wall. Each of these walls is 18 inches thick. This airplane, or whatever struck it, went through six of these walls. Six 18-inch walls at a total of 9 feet of solid Kevlar-reinforced concrete. And I have the exit hole coming out the third ring into a light well. This hole is about 10 feet in diameter. So whatever tore into this thing, it came in at about a 50-degree angle. It bored directly, like a drill bit, went straight through six of these blast-resistant walls right through. Clean through. Now, a Boeing 757 fuselage cannot do that. It would have collapsed, because these, as I said, they're aluminum tubes. That's all they are.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no crater, there's a 16-foot hole, and then there's this one massive hole that goes all the way through it. The next day I have photographs of, the only thing that could do that, in my opinion, is a nose cone of a craft that is coated in, or made of, depleted uranium, which is a very, very hard substance which leaves radioactive residue, and it heats up upon contact, which is what facilitates penetration. And I think this is supported by the fact that the next day there were FEMA crews in anti-radiation suits who were actually decontaminating the interior of the crash site. Now, what are people in anti-radiation suits doing in there? So that's something else we ought to ponder.
That's an interesting point.
And then we have the removal of the evidence. I have CNN footage and NBC footage from news helicopters. Within minutes of this whole thing, after the fires have been put out, you have a row of people in civilian attire. They look like office employees in a long row, about 30 to 40 people abreast, shoulder to shoulder, very slowly walking down this lawn, combing it minutely, looking down, picking up pieces of debris. Now, where in the world have you seen a crash site being scavenged and scrubbed of all evidence within minutes of a crash site? This is a crash site. You're supposed to have NTSB people at least out here looking at the debris to find out what happened. These guys.
Well, it's a crime scene.
It.
I mean, basically a crime scene. 189 people were killed there.
And then within that same time period, there is a pallet, a very large pallet, with some large object on it. It is completely covered by a blue tarp, and it is being hoisted by about 10 to a dozen men. Some of these guys have come so physically completely out of shape. One guy's got a huge gut on him, wearing suspenders, and they're all wearing ties. They've all got white shirts on. These look like federal officers. They're carrying this huge piece covered in a blue tarp, concealed, I should say, in a blue tarp, away from a crime scene again. So who was scrubbing this crime scene and why? Why was all this stuff being taken out? By the way,
well, you know something interesting, Neil, and I said 189 people died there. I should say allegedly, because I really don't think, after looking at how they treated that the passengers and what happened in that whole aspect of this cover-up, that there were passengers, 65 or whatever passengers on that plane.
Yeah.
I don't really think they were there. But anyway, that's another whole other story.
Yeah, I don't believe they were there, because if the FEMA dogs, the sniffing dogs that were taken in, couldn't sniff out anything. When you ask the government what happened to the airplane, well, the fire was so hot, it evaporated. That's the argument, absurd as it is. That's what you get in return. Now, but the fire was so hot it evaporated all the aluminum and steel, but still it was cool enough so it beautifully preserved the remains of these passengers.
And I did something on this, and you'd probably be interested in this little story, and I'll make it quick so we can get back to these technical things I'm interested in. But I talked to a man by the name of Captain Ingledew from the Virginia Beach Fire Department who got there 48 hours after the scene. His description of what he saw conflicts from a couple people I talked to who were there right after the scene. But anyway, it's too long to get into now. But he said what was really strange is he looked down and he found just laying in what he called complete devastation, a completely intact California ID and driver's license of Susan Calley, supposedly one of the passengers.
This was planted in, it was a plant, we know it. This is the same thing as what happened in the Twin Towers. They found one of the hijackers' passport. I mean, that passport must have been made out of ballistic Kevlar, because it tore through the man's jacket pocket, it tore through the fuselage of the aircraft, it tore through a fireball, it tore through the concrete of the Twin Towers and landed on the sidewalk so an FBI officer can go find it.
Well, I have a story that'll be out tomorrow on my website, which is going to also tell you how four cards, completely intact, were returned to one of the Flight 77 or Flight 11 families. Four credit cards returned in perfect condition of one of the supposed passengers. More evidence, miraculous evidence, and it's just amazing to me. But what I wanted to get at regarding the Pentagon, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the government released a month and a half afterwards a complete autopsy report saying that they identified 184 of the 189 passengers, including all but one of the passengers on the plane, positively through DNA, positively through dental records. I talked to doctors that said that's next to impossible. To do that in such a quick period of time, considering the scene, Unbelievable, Neela. Can you believe that?
I've heard that myself. It truly is. I mean, all of this stuff is unbelievable. I don't know how people swallowed it. I mean, I did, and I'm sure you did for a while because,
Well, yeah. I mean, this thing was this thing is such a massive thing that you have to begin to. Once you start looking into it, you see all the holes, and I always say it's like just a huge, big piece of Swiss cheese. But the real interesting thing that you mentioned, let's go back to one issue, and you might be able to add something here.
Greg,
but I remember I was talking to Chuck Whittingham, Russ Whittingham, a pilot, and he said one of the things that he thought was so strange was that when this transponder went off, the plane becomes a blip. You no longer, as a flight controller, can read much about what's going on. Where he says that he talked to a flight controller or even has transcripts of them describing exactly everything about this airplane, saying that it seemed like somebody was scripting this flight controller.
Well,
now tell us when a transponder goes off, what does an airplane look like to a flight controller? Are you aware of that?
Well, there are two types of transponders and two types of radar. One is, of course, military radar, which is run by NORAD, and the other is FAA. And now, if you turn the transponder off, it'll go off the screen on FAA traffic screens. But on a NORAD screen, they can paint the aircraft. They can see it very clearly. They might lose some of the heading information or altitude information, but they can definitely see the airplane.
It would be impossible for a normal flight controller to have any kind of idea what was going on, correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. There is a flight controller basically giving information about this plane coming in even after the transponder was off, which Mr. Whittingham said was very unusual.
That is definitely unusual, but then again, if it put a NORAD radar, it would not be unusual. A military radar would still pick it up because they can paint the target. You know, people don't realize NORAD, these guys have the capability, the surveillance, electronic surveillance capability to see a butterfly in space. I mean, it's and here we have four large airliners cruising all around this country along the eastern seaboard for 1.5 hours, and NORAD does nothing? It's crazy. It is so absurd, you can't even address this.
Yeah, I mean, in some of the most highly protected airspace in the world.
Absolutely.
Both the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
That's correct.
You know what also is interesting, and we get into some things regarding no surveillance tapes.
You know, I was going to come to that. Greg, by the way, I have to correct something you said. American Airlines Flight 77 only had 56 people on board.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Anyway, that's the detail. Now, when it comes to camera, now here we go. I've heard that there are 9 cameras on each side of the Pentagon. There's 45 cameras in total. We could have had a ringside view of what it was that flew into this building. Amazingly, all 45 cameras decided to go south on us that day. Not one. There were three cameras that could have had a beautiful view of what came in. One was atop a Citgo gas station, which was on non-government property, from what I understand, about a mile out, that was focused directly on the east lawn. The other one was atop a Hilton hotel that was nearby, and the third one was atop a tower on I-135. It was a traffic camera. Within an hour of the crash, FBI personnel turned up at all three sites and removed the tapes, never to be seen again. In fact, when they went into the Hilton, the employees were actually about to watch this tape, and it was taken out.
Yeah, and I don't think they've ever spoken about what they saw either.
No, they haven't. That's presuming that they had seen something, or perhaps they didn't see anything, because the tape was taken out before they could. But what happened to these three tapes? So isn't it amazing that this citadel, a veritable citadel in the most technologically and militarily powerful nation on the planet, there's not one iota, not a modicum of evidence about Boeing 757 striking it? I mean, this is preposterous. Still, people believe it.
Now, why is that? I mean, is it just there, just a blind belief in our government? I can't believe this.
That's it, mate. We've been preconditioned to believe that whatever we are told is indeed true. Don't question it, because now, as Bush says, it's unpatriotic to question anything. So, obviously, you say, well, And then, of course, this whole thing comes about a conspiracy theory. Now, I can't stand that term. You know, you can't argue with the laws of physics. There are conspiracy theories and there are conspiracy facts. When you deal with physics and the hard sciences, these are facts. Take the Twin Towers, for instance.
So we got to take a break. Neela, we'll be back with our final segment with Neela Sagadevan. It's a great talk to you, and I'll be back in 3 minutes. We're back with our final few minutes here with Neela Sagadevan. A aeronautical engineer has given us a fascinating look on how it was impossible to fly that Boeing 757 into the Pentagon. Neil, I need to make some time here, a couple minutes. So first, I know that you're going to be in Tampa with Reopen, some people from Reopen 9/11.org for a 9/11 Truth Seminar coming up. Tell us when that is and who will be speaking. Hello? Neil, are you there? He must have dropped off the line. But anyway, Neil, are you with us? Okay. We will see if we can get Neela Sagadevan back on the line for the final few minutes with us. He is talking to us about how it was impossible to commandeer that Boeing 757 into the Pentagon. And it's a fascinating story. He gave us some aeronautical tips on why that was impossible. He's also written a book I wanted to get into, and we're hopefully going to get him back on the line. Neela, are you with us yet?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you're back. Okay, good. Good. We had a little technical difficulty there for a minute. I wanted to mention in our last few minutes here, and perhaps we can hold you over a few more minutes afterwards, so just hang on the line at the break. But anyway, tell us about, I know that you're going to be at a 9/11 Truth Seminar, a number of people speaking in Tampa coming up with the 9/11 Reopen Group. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's in Tampa on the 7th and 8th, and in Miami Beach on the 9th. And it's sponsored by Jimmy Walker, an American philanthropist, multimillionaire, and an industrialist who lives in Europe, from what I understand. And it's a symposium comprised of a number of experts. You have MIT physicists, you have fighter pilots, defense specialists, and so forth, who address the various aspects of 9/11. But since we're short on time, I'd like to say something very quickly, which I was about to say earlier, Greg, on the Twin Towers, that your listeners will get a good idea. We covered the Pentagon in great detail, but I'd like to ask them to ponder this. How is it that these two towers, 1,350 feet tall, designed, most people don't get this, they were designed to take the full frontal impact of a Boeing 707, a fully loaded Boeing 707 flying at 600 miles per hour. In fact, if you do the math, the kinetic energy of a Boeing 707 doing 600 miles per hour is about 10% greater than a fully loaded 757 doing 500 miles per hour. Anyway, these were designed with 600% redundancy in the central core section to take a hit. Both of them collapse into powder. People don't realize that these collapses occurred in less than 10 seconds. That is tantamount to a free fall. What a free fall means is there are no supports at all. I wrote a piece recently where I go through a very fundamental thought experiment. I tell people, imagine if there was this magical crane that somehow disconnected or decoupled the 110th floor and held it up for a minute, and you called the genie in and told him, listen, remove all of the floors, all the 109 floors beneath it. Now, if you had the genie cut the cable of this crane, the 110th floor would hit the ground in about 9.2 seconds, 9.2 to 9.3 seconds. Now, carry the thought experiment further, but tell the genie, you know, don't make the 109 floors disappear, but simply soften all the vertical supports into imaginary beams of rubber, let's say. Don't you think every one of these beams, even though they're soft and pliant and in the process of collapsing, are going to offer some degree of support to the 110th floor? Don't you think it's going to slow this whole thing down? People don't realize that nothing slowed the 110th floor. It hit the deck in 9.2 seconds.
Hey, Neela, can you stay with us for a few more minutes for another segment after the break?
Sure.
Okay, good. Just hang on with us, and we'll be back with Neela Sagadevan. I want to talk a little bit about his book, War Painted the Gods. We'll be back in 3 minutes on the Investigative Journal. Back for the second hour of the Investigative Journal. We're going to stick with Neela Sagadevan. I find this really interesting stuff. He's telling us about the aeronautical engineering aspects of why the Pentagon crash was impossible. Neela, you left off with some things about the World Trade Center. We have some time this half hour, so tell us where you left off with regarding the World Trade Center.
Hi, Greg. I know we had some technical difficulties. Am I back on?
You're back on right now. Did you hear what I was saying?
Yes, I did.
Okay, go ahead.
What I was saying was that these towers were designed to take a hit. Still, they collapsed in a state of free fall. Complete free fall, which means there was not one supporting beam that was resisting its collapse. The only way this can be achieved is through what we call controlled demolition. Controlled demolition is a process through whereby charges are placed on supporting members and they're designed to blow them out of the way so everything collapses in a neat pile. There is no other way that these towers could have come down. In fact, Jimmy Walter has a $1 million prize out. It's up for the taking, up for grabs. Anyone, all of your listeners, if you know any physicists out there, I've sent this out to over 150 physics and engineering departments of universities around the world. Not one person can prove. The prize simply says, if you can prove that the towers collapsed without the use of explosives, we will pay you $1 million. You can't do it. It's impossible.
Yeah, that's quite an offer, and I really... has anyone taken him up on it yet?
Not one. Not a single person. You see the thing. Once again, we go back to why do we believe this thing? Every time you bring this up, people just cut you off saying, listen, we saw the airplanes fly into it. The airplanes were a diversion. This is what is impinged on our minds. You see an airplane flying in, you're shown this repeatedly, and then you see the towers come down. So you put two and two together and presume, well, the plane brought the tower down. End of story. There's nothing further to discuss. Wrong. Get the plane out of the equation. Those towers could not have collapsed in free fall without explosives. If anyone out there knows how they did, tell Jimmy Walter we got $1 million coming your way.
You heard it. You heard it here on the Investigative Journal. $1 million offer if you can prove that the explosives weren't used in the World Trade Center. One thing that was interesting, and I know you are aware of this, a physics professor from Brigham Young recently came out a week ago. He was on my show a week ago Monday. And he discussed the same thing, and I just wanted to get your comments about Dr. Stephen Jones and what you thought about that.
I know Dr. Stephen Jones. In fact, we've been in communication here for quite a while. We've exchanged a number of notes, and I'm in full concurrence with what he says, because he's a professor of physics. Who am I to argue with him? Au contraire, I completely agree with what he says. Another thing, Greg, the pools of molten steel. Molten steel. People don't realize that jet fuel, which is basically kerosene, does not have the thermodynamic potential to melt or even weaken steel. You can take 100,000 gallons of kerosene, pour it on the steel and set fire to it and sit around and watch it burn. Nothing is going to happen to that steel. Still, when right after the towers settled, for three weeks, all that was left way down deep in the basements was bubbling, molten, liquid metal. And the only thing that can do that is explosives. And the explosive that leaves molten metal as a byproduct is called thermite. And it also, one of its other byproducts is a white powder. Look at these explosions. It's all white powder. I have NASA imagery of the crash sites, of the sites of the Twin Towers. You're looking at 2,250 degree temperatures that remained underground for 3 weeks. Where did this... I mean, let's say these things just collapsed in free fall. What?
Neela, you hold that thought. We're going to stick with you for this hour. This is fascinating stuff. I still want to get into your book. We'll be back in 3 minutes with Neela Sagadevan on the Investigative Journal. Okay, we're into our second hour with our aeronautical engineer and pilot, Neela Sagadevan, talking about the Pentagon. Neela, I know you're also mentioning some things about the free fall of the World Trade Center. Did you have a chance to look at the flight maneuvers of these planes that supposedly hit the Pentagon or hit the World Trade Center?
Yes, I did, and I didn't really want to get into that, Greg, because once again, none of these guys could have pulled off that maneuver. And I'm convinced that those were not Boeing 767s. I believe that they were Boeing 737s, which in plan, form, and profile are very, very similar unless you juxtapose them in flight. They're almost identical in appearance while in flight. And the reason I say it was a 737, because I have a picture of one of the engines which tore through the South Tower and landed at the intersection of Green and Church Street, I believe it was, and it's been cordoned off, and there's an FBI guy standing guard over it, and that engine is a CFM-56. I have had that confirmed by a number of mechanics. I have the manuals on the CFM-56 engine, as well as the RB211 Rolls-Royce engines, and whatever tore through that building is not an engine from a 767. So what happened to the 767s? No idea. Your guess is as good as mine. I think they would detoured over the Atlantic and shot down, believe it or not. How? Why? Many people don't realize. On the morning of 9/11, there were 5 war games, military exercises underway on the Canadian border. That's the reason most of our fighters had been taken away from the eastern seaboard. And one of those exercises, called the Vigilant Guardian, had to do with the simulated hijacking of commercial airliners. Now, is that not quite coincidental? Simulated hijackings of commercial airliners on the morning of 9/11 in military exercises that are not even touched on in the 9/11 Commission's report. And at one point, FAA radar consoles were showing 22 potential targets. When I say targets, potentially hijacked airplanes. There was absolute pandemonium breaking out. You had air traffic controllers calling around saying, is this exercise or is it real world? Nobody knew which was which. And I believe it was during this melee that these airplanes were somehow detoured, vectored off, or remotely controlled and vectored off, and flown out over the seaboard and shot down. In fact, I've spoken with the U.S. Air Force Colonel, retired, Colonel Don de Grandpre, who says that he knows one of the pilots who shot it down, an F-16 pilot from the North Dakota Air National Guard. So, there's a lot of evidence about it. Pennsylvania, that airplane that made that hole in the ground, which was cordoned off, nobody was allowed anywhere near it. People were 8 miles away from the crash site, saw confetti-like material coming down over a lake. There were people who... So, this aircraft, whatever it was that crashed, was shot down as well. So this is why I put this whole thing together, because still there are too many holes. I don't have all the answers. I don't think anyone does, certainly none of the researchers. But someone somewhere knows what happened on that day. But getting back to the Twin Towers, here we have free fall, we have molten steel that's bubbling underground. Where is this source of energy? The only source of energy that can explain all of these manifestations is explosives, nothing else. We have 4 million cubic feet, Greg, of concrete that was pulverized into a 40-micron pyroclastic dust cloud that floated all the way out to New Jersey. Where did the energy come from to convert all this? Let's say all of these, you know, people say, the NIST engineering report says that all of these floors pancaked. Let's say they did. People don't realize under each of these floors was a tray of galvanized steel, corrugated galvanized steel. If all of these 110 floors fell down neatly, A, they would not have fallen at the free fall speed, but let's say they all collapsed. What you would have ended up would have been a stack of 110 floors neatly piled up, fractured, broken into pieces possibly, but certainly not turned into dust, because they're all separated by the steel. And the most important thing, right in the middle of this pancake of 110 floors, would be this enormous 47-beam central core, an incredibly strong core that were designed to take virtually all of the loads on this structure, sticking up 1,350 feet into the sky. What happened to the core? The 9/11 Commission does not answer that. They simply say it disappeared. I mean, this thing is a joke. And to think that wars have been started. As we speak, Greg, there are people, children, women, being killed all over the world on this war on terror, all because of a black operation conducted by our own government. This is lunacy.
Yeah, I agree with you totally, Neela. What I wanted to just break in here and say, if you want to call in the second half hour, we're going to stick with Neela Sagadevan and discuss 9/11 at 800-313-9443. We're taking some calls. And by the way, Neela, the one question I had to ask you is, talking about 9/11 4 years after the fact, I bring it up and I stick with this story only because I feel that it's very, very important. It's almost like a cancer in our country. And if we don't treat this problem, if we don't deal with this, I don't believe we can deal with our other problems. What's your thought about that? Because some people say, you know, you're just wasting your time trying to bring this information up. It's never going to be dealt with. I don't agree with that. I agree if enough people get together, we can get rid of this cancer, and that is my feeling. It's very important that we do deal with this if we want to gain respect in the world again, and also, like you said, end these terrible wars that have been started over this.
You know, Greg, such an argument, if I were to be confronted with it, I would simply ignore it and walk away. Because to me, this is the singularly most significant issue of our times. This is the most heinous crime in human history. This is evil. We are talking about evildoers in the axis of evil. That's nonsense. The evildoers are here. There is a cabal within our own government, believe it or not. Because unless you're in a state of complete denial and you say, no, I don't believe it, that can't be. But the laws of physics, the laws of science, the facts that, as they are, cannot lie. We have to get beyond this threshold, this disbelief of denial, to understand that what I am telling you and what you've been telling your listeners and what hundreds, thousands of other researchers are telling people is that what we are being told is impossible. It is physically impossible. Until you get that into your head, you will never see the light. But if you say that this is not important, or I should say to those who say this is not important, I'd say you're mad. This is the most important issue of our times. There are wars being fought. Our constitution is being changed. Our rights are being taken away from us. We've been lied to. And our entire governmental system, our democratic system, is being reshaped based on a lie. How could anyone say this is insignificant or unimportant?
I agree with you totally, Neela. Do you want to take a call? I have Jim in Kansas. Jim, you're on the Investigative Journal. Jim? Jim, are you there? Hi, he must have dropped off the line. Neela, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll continue when Jim gets back on. Kelly's in the back there. Let me know, Kelly, and we'll take Jim's question. But, yeah, it is the single most important issue, and to forget about it, I mean, to just say that it's impossible. And, you know, people feel helpless in this country, and I really am miffed by it because there are so many, many facts that point to the government involvement here that it's just, first of all, the cover-up and then the benefit. Who benefits from this? All these people, like all these government contractors and all these corporations who are benefiting from this war and
Greg,
these lies, I mean, it needs to be stopped. And, it's going to be people like you with this type of information, this technical information that can back up just the other of us who talk about it and do not come forward with this kind of information. Any last thoughts you had before we get into your book about the Pentagon?
Not really. I mean, there's too much to discuss on this thing. But, you know, people are in a state of disbelief. Even myself, as an engineer and a commercial pilot, I mean, I never gave it a second thought for 3 years. So if I didn't get into this, I can understand why there's a reluctance on the part of the average person out in the street to go ahead and resonate with this kind of information, because it strikes you as, quote, impossible. And that's unfortunate.
And you know what? I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I talked to people, in fact, talked to a reporter who has been a reporter in Salt Lake City for 30 years, and she didn't know anything about any idea that the World Trade Center was a possible government cover-up until she talked to Professor Jones. So this tells you the involvement of the media in this story.
You know, and people got to realize there are so many, there are hundreds of academics, physics professors, engineering professors around the world who are saying the same thing repeatedly. Now, here I'm looking at somebody, if I can quote very quickly, this is by Professor James Fetzer, and this man is a McKnight University professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota. He says, quote, if the temperature of jet fuel is not sufficient to melt structural steel, if the rate at which the buildings fell approximates free fall, if the sequence in which they fell is not the sequence in which they were hit, if the energy produced was not equal to that required to turn concrete into fine dust, if the heat produced was not sufficient to convert tons of steel into pools of molten metal, and if the damage to the Pentagon is far less than what would have been produced by a Boeing 707 weighing more than 100 tons, then there is an objective scientific evidence, or there is objective scientific evidence, that the official account cannot be sustained. He says it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And you know something, Neela? We've got calls being backed up now. Our phones are filled. And if you want to call, just keep trying to get through. I'm going to start taking these calls. We're going to take a break in a minute. But you can call us at 800 313-944.
You want me to call you?
What's that?
Do you want me to call you to get through to the callers?
Oh, no, no, no. You just stay on, Neela, because we're going to take these callers one by one. I'm just mentioning, though, that our phones may be backed up. So just you hold on because they have some questions for you. And Jim in Kansas, you got a minute here, then we'll get to you after the break also. So are you back with us?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah,
okay, I'm sorry that happened. Go ahead.
For a minute, I thought I heard an airplane hit your telephone. No, I just wondered.
Jim, okay, we're doing it to you. The music's on. You hold. We're going to get to you right after the break. And then we got Dylan in Texas, Larry in Texas, Sam in Missouri, all for Neela. We'll be back on the Investigative Journal. Hey, no time to waste here on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski, here every day from 12 to 2 on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You can handle the truth, and you're listening to it today from Neela Sagadevan. If you're trying to call us and you'll get a busy signal, just keep calling. The lines are jammed as usual on the Investigative Journal, but call us at 800-313-9443. You will get through. And, Jim, you're back with us. Jim in Kansas.
Yes.
You're on the Investigative Journal. You have a question for Neela.
Yes, Neela, there is one similarity between all three attacks, both the North, the South Tower, and the Pentagon.
You're cutting out. Can you get a little closer to your phone?
Boy, I guess so. Anyway, there is a similarity between all three impacts, and I'm pretty sure it was a shape charge in all three cases. Do you know what a shape charge is, Neil?
Yes, I do.
Okay, they're shaped like a bell, and it fires a blast straight ahead, okay? Well, the Pentagon had the great big hole through three of the buildings. That had to be a shape charge. That's all it was, too.
I imagine it was a shape charge, yes. In fact, I have the name of the type and the model of the charge as well.
Right. The South Tower, the fuselage of the airplane came completely through the building and stuck out the other side about 40 feet. I measured it by measuring on my computer, and roughly I'd say 40 foot of it stuck out. Then the first building, the North Tower, all of the blast, and it had to be a blast, came out the left side of the building. Well, not all of it, some of it, or not the majority of it.
Mm-hmm.
If in both North and South Towers, there was a flash right before it hit the building.
Yes.
That flash had to be a shape charge to make a hole for that aircraft to go through. But on the North Tower, the shape charge hit the center support columns, which was solid concrete and steel. That stopped it. Now, do you think that's possible?
I'm with you on the shape charge on the Pentagon, but I don't believe there were shape charges used on the Twin Towers.
Well, find
because
that
even
picture.
If there was a shape charge device aboard those airplanes, the destruction would have been very local on the central core. We had explosions going off down in the basement. William Rodriguez, who was the janitorial manager in the Twin Towers, he rescued people from blast injuries down in the basements.
So a shape charge would not have anything to do with the falling down. It would have to do with it, the fact that the airplane came clear through the building and stuck out on the far side.
That is possible, but I can't understand why in the case of the Twin Towers... By the way, I'm not discounting what you're saying. Well, I'd like you to explain to me why it would be necessary in a building that has already been pre-wired for a controlled demo. Why would you need a shape charge? Perhaps to... I do believe some explosive device was used locally to ignite the fuel. Just it would have been awfully embarrassing if the plane crashed into it and nothing lit up. So I think the flash that you're speaking of, which you can see very clearly in Dave Von Kleist's movie 9/11 in Plain Sight, could have been an initiating device for a charge, or perhaps a shape charge by itself. This is possible.
Well,
may I ask you guys a question for our listeners who may not know what a shape charge is, and myself included? What is that?
It's an explosive shaped like a bell.
Okay.
When it goes off, the outward force drives the inward force to a central point and forward. And
okay.
The one I saw, it looked like a telephone pole had been driven into the ground 14 foot deep and pulled right back out.
Okay, imagine
Jim,
if you can.
Jim, do you have any other questions for Neela?
Well, this point of the second tower particularly, where the aircraft went clear through it, it had to be something that made a hole for that fuselage to go through. Now, true, it was a 737 and it was a refueling aircraft.
Do you agree with Neela that it was a 737?
Yeah. The engines were mounted way down on a low pylon. The only ones they did that on were the refueling aircraft because they had to have a bigger engine.
These were military tankers. I agree with you.
Right, absolutely. Now, the fact that it came through would mean that the fuel tank holding the fuel for refueling burst. The fuel went forward in the aircraft and made that nose a solid object.
That's possible.
And it pushed it right on through.
Yeah. Jim, I can discuss many of these points, but I don't think we're really going to get to the heart of the towers collapsing through a controlled demo. What I'm trying to prove, and what all physicists I know can easily prove, is that this thing was a controlled demolition. What we're getting to here is the semantics and the details of how we trigger the initial explosion.
You're right. We're on two different subjects there.
Hey, Jim, thanks a lot. Great questions on the Investigative Journal. And Neela, before we take a break here, we're going to get to some more callers in the second half hour. So Dylan, Larry, and Sam, just hold on. We want to get to you on the Investigative Journal. And by the way, if you want to call us, you can chime in here on the Pentagon and on the World Trade Center towers collapse at 800-313-9443. I'd like to hear from you. Neela, the question I have also is, you brought it up with William Rodriguez. One very important point that I've always made is once a investigation is taken, you look at, one, the physical evidence, which they tried to cover up by FEMA taking away the steel immediately after. Secondly, they begin a scientific argument to defray any kind of basically what I call many, many eyewitnesses who have been silenced about hearing the explosions and actually being burnt down below in the basement
by these explosions. By the way, the thing is, Greg, there is no scientific argument. NIST's argument is a non-argument because they only carry the argument up until the point of initiation of collapse, nothing thereafter. And there they use computer modeling to take the theoretical possibilities to absurd extremes to try and fit it into their model of facts. So it's not an argument. It would be a joke to any physicist.
And I'll tell you something. After the break, I want to tell you about what the 9/11 Commission has done. They have a private fund now that funded a group that goes around the country to spread lies about 9/11. They were here in Spokane, Washington, just a couple weeks ago. And I'll tell you what they say about people like you who are saying the Twin Towers came down from a controlled demolition on the Investigative Journal. Okay, we're back for the last half hour of the Investigative Journal. And Neela, I'll get into this disinformation campaign that's going on by funded through private enterprise through the 9/11 Commission to spread basically lies about 9/11 and to discredit people like you. And I'll get into that. But we got a whole bunch of callers, and I've got to get to them. Dylan in Texas, you're on the Investigative Journal.
Hi there, and hi, Neela.
Hi, Dylan.
What's your book, sir?
My book is not at all about 9/11. It's a book called War Paint of the Gods, and it asks the question, what is God's religion? It's a discussion on the absurdity of fighting wars and killing people in the name of God. Carlos Santana was asked during a CNN interview a while ago, hey, Carlos, what's your religion? And Santana says, if you can tell me God's religion, that's my religion. And left off me thinking. I mean, you know, it's so crazy. And most of the wars today are being fought in the name of gods and different religions. And that's what the book is about. It's called War Paint of the Gods.
All right. Well, that sounds real interesting. May I ask you about your education and training? What kind of type of degree do you have, and where did you go to school?
I had a degree in aeronautical engineering, majoring in aerodynamics from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. At the moment, I hold an FAA ATP. And airline transport rating.
So you were a commercial airline pilot? Were you in the military? Well, what about your pilot experience?
Commercial experience. I have about 6,000 hours.
So what airline did you work for?
I'd rather not get into my employers.
Okay, that's fine. Now. I was just interested in your education and training. I was in the Air Reserves here in Texas, and I worked on jet engines and... I concur with everything you're saying, and God bless you.
Thank you, Dylan. I appreciate it. By the way, if you'd like to email me, I can get into a personal discussion.
What is your email, sir?
You can send it to Neela at warpaintofthegods.com.
Okay.
N-E-L-A?
N-I-L-A.
Warpaint?
N-I-L-A. Or I'll give you a short one. NILA22@cox.net.
You got that, Dylan? Okay. Let's get to another phone call here. Larry in Texas, you're on the Investigative Journal.
Hi, Greg. Good show, as usual.
Thank you.
Good show, Neil. You're doing a good job.
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring up something that I haven't discussed on RBN yet. There are two ladies that I'm here in Texas. that moved as what they said as far away as they could from New York. One of them was a worker for the city, for New York City, and they actually brought them. They were black ladies, and they don't normally work in the trade towers, but they took a bunch of them and said, "I'm sorry, but we're going to have to go to meetings for 2 days over at the trade towers on Tuesday," and they were to report over there. They said there were no supervisors or above in the towers when it happened. And
You're talking, they had meetings on 9/11, correct?
Yes, correct.
And these ladies are now living in near you in Texas?
Yes, they are.
And where do you live, Larry?
I'm just south of Austin.
Okay, go ahead.
So, anyways, these ladies, I've actually shown them videos and they're giving them to them. They're still scared to death to even talk about it. But they said that on Friday before 9/11, they went through the buildings and they went to each of the employees and told them they all had to fill out this 3x5 card that said who their beneficiaries were with their Social Security numbers, their beneficiaries' Social Security numbers. And one of these ladies said they did it a year before, and at that time she said, "What in the world do you need this for?" And they said, "We get it every year." She said, "No, you don't. I've worked here for years and no one's ever gotten this." Well, they came again on the Friday before 9/11 and had them all fill this out and said, she said, "Well, you already have that information." They said, "We need it today. Everyone has to have it." And she was frantically calling her kids trying to get their Social Security numbers. But she remembered that. Another thing she said, that coming to work on Friday, she noticed that on top of the buildings around, they were setting up cameras. And she thought, "Oh, wow, they're going to be doing, you know, a movie around here or something." And they were setting up cameras with tracks. She said, like little train tracks where they could move them back and forth. And so apparently all that was set up as well. And
on
those
top
were first-hand experience. Not on top of the World Trade Center, but some other buildings around.
I see.
So apparently,
you know, Larry, before you hang up, have Kelly in the back get some contact information, because one of the interesting things about 9/11, I think, is to find some people in these insurance companies who want to talk about how easily they paid out claims after 9/11 without even really checking into the stories on a lot of people. And I bet you can find out some really damaging information regarding that. So make sure you leave a contact number with Kelly. Any other? Do you have a specific question?
Well,
if not, I'll let you go.
No, I didn't. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much. Interesting.
Sam in Missouri, you're on the Investigative Journal.
Hey, good afternoon. It's a good broadcast.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
You bet. I just wanted to comment one of the reasons that I think we need to really keep this alive is because of the fact that with the evidence overwhelming the way that it is, if enough people really woke up and saw the light on this, this could possibly derail another terrorist attack in this country. And all you need to do is go back to a statement that was made by former military general Tommy Franks, who made the statement that if another terrorist attack were to happen, he put it, in the Western Hemisphere, that our Constitution would likely be suspended and be replaced by a military form of government. And with the stuff that I've been seeing, both after 9/11, after Hurricane Katrina disaster, different things like that, we have elements within our government that are just itching to throw us under military rule. And as far as the evidence of this, another smoking gun to me is this whole issue of Larry Silverstein, the guy who took possession of the buildings there fairly recently before that. He had ordered tower number 7 pulled later that afternoon. Well, those explosives would have had to have been there for a long time. You just don't go placing explosives and wiring buildings suddenly ready for demolition. And my question is, why were the buildings wired in the first place all this time? And how did it get done unless somebody would have had to go in under disguise to do work on the buildings? Because, you know, there's people going in and out of large buildings like that 24 hours a day in varying degrees. So my curiosity is that I think it's beyond the shadow of a doubt we can conclude that explosives were in the buildings, that it was a controlled demolition. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. The question is, why were they put there? When were they put there?
You know, you're absolutely 100% right on that. We didn't even touch on Building 7 because we've been talking about the Pentagon and the Twin Towers. Where I'm concerned, Building 7 is the smoking gun. Straight out of Larry Silverstein's mouth on PBS during an interview, he said, there was so much loss of life, I paraphrase, but this is what he said, there's been so much loss of life, and I told the fire department to go ahead and pull the building, and we pulled it. And you're right, pulling a building, a 49-story skyscraper, steel-framed skyscraper, would take a minimum of 6 months to go ahead and do your survey, to do the planning, to do the implementation, to load up the explosives. These guys couldn't have done it on 9/11. All the roads were sealed off. People couldn't have even got to these buildings to do it. So you're absolutely right, caller. This was done months in advance. And who did it? Your question's as good as mine. I think Silverstein was part of this whole thing. I know Giuliani was. If you look at Giuliani's control structure, was occupied four floors in Building 7. This thing had two-inch plate glass windows designed to withstand 160-mile-per-hour winds. It had its own air supply. Air supply? Have you heard of buildings having their own localized air supplies? It had its own power supply. This thing was designed as a bulletproof control center for something very, very important. And I believe that Building 7 was brought down to destroy the evidence of what was in there.
You got it. Absolutely. Neil,
good analysis.
You want to call us?
Thanks a lot, Sam. 800-313-9443. There may be a line open. Vic in Ontario, you have a question for Neela on the Investigative Journal.
Yes, I do. It's a great show. I was used to work as a construction engineering technician, and I'm wondering, like in the military, sensitive equipment is made with self-destruct mechanisms implanted. I'm just wondering when the towers were built, if the demolition charges could have been placed during construction. And that's because when they collapsed, I just couldn't believe my eyes when I was watching them on television and from the planes hitting them, collapsing like that. It had to be a controlled demolition.
Well, you know, if I may just chime in here a little bit, what I think, you know, I don't know when these explosives were put in there. It's obvious there was a controlled demolition in all three buildings. But, you know, what's also suspicious is that the Bush family had control of that security firm in the World Trade Center for some time. And so I think they had access to that building, and they had full, complete knowledge of what was going on inside there. So, you know, that in itself is suspect. So we have to remember that. Neil, any thoughts on that?
Could I speak to that question? The gentleman brought up a very interesting point. It is possible, but I would consider it extremely unlikely for one reason, the reliability factor. Those explosives would have been had to have placed 30-some years ago, and no one who's planning a controlled demolition is going to rely on the condition or the integrity of a system that is that old. These had to have been freshly planted. And now I come back to what Greg just said. He's absolutely right. 6 months before these towers came down, before 9/11, we changed two companies were changed. Well, three things happened. The ownership of the Twin Towers and the entire WTC complex changed ownership. The first time in 35 years, it was bought by Larry Silverstein. The first thing he did,
Correct. Changed
insurance companies, and change security companies. The security company that was brought in was Securicom. Securicom, the CEO of Securicom was Marvin Bush, George Bush's brother, and the president was Wirt Walker, Bush's cousin. So once you have, and by the way, Securicom was also the security company for Dulles International Airport and for American Airlines, for everything that associated with 9/11. So when people ask me, okay, who went ahead and how did these guys gain access to plant these explosives? Very easy. If you own the security company, if you see a maintenance man walking around your office, you're not going to question what he's doing. He gets into the drop ceiling. A standard charge pack would probably weigh less than 5 pounds. I would say 2 to 3 pounds of explosive. It's strapped onto a load-bearing member, and its radio device could have a simple 9-volt battery plugged into it. These are all radio devices. It's not like the old days where you could trail wires around a building and take it to a plunger somewhere to pull down. These are all radio control devices, and it's very, very easy to do.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay, Vic, thanks a lot. Vicki in Idaho, how are you today, Vicki? You're on the Investigative Journal.
Hi, fine, thanks. I was wondering if you have done any research on the internal battle going on in the Pentagon between the old line military and the transformation people.
I've only heard probably the same stuff that you have, and the rumors that I have heard. This again from Colonel Don de Grand Prix, a retired Air Force colonel, who says that we were on the verge of a military coup in the Pentagon. And that's all I know, and I find that very plausible.
Well, that's kind of what I've been thinking, too, is that there's an organization called BEND. And what it is Business Executives for National Security. And it's all the high technology firms. And basically, they're the ones that are guiding transformation of the military. And they're doing things like, you know, supply chain management in replacing military logistics, which is why, you know, our guys were sent over to Iraq without protective gear. I mean, supply chain management is, you know, grocery store restocking.
Sure.
You know, it's insane. But I was doing some research this morning, and apparently there were problems between the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Shelton, you know, General Shelton, and what's his name, Rumsfeld. But anyway, on the transformation plans for transformation, they basically took the plans from Benz, and those corporations, one of them is Cisco. Cisco said they wanted to be a Chinese corporation. You know, I have a link to that article.
Interesting, interesting, Vicki. Yeah. Neela, you were mentioning today something quite interesting, and thanks again, Vicki, for your comments.
Thank you, Vicki.
I guess you saw CNN this morning, and not only do some of the Pentagon people, military people, have some problems, but what about this X that came across the face of Dick Cheney,
you know,
on CNN? That was interesting. I didn't see that.
It happened yesterday. You can see the picture on Rense.com, R-E-N-S-E.com. And evidently, Cheney was speaking to a group yesterday morning around 10 o'clock or so. And on CNN, and I have the screen capture of it, a huge, big, fat X started flashing straight on Cheney's face. And this is amazing. I don't know what it was. It's under investigation, but heaven knows who was responsible for that.
Somebody in CNN is telling us they're done with Cheney. They're going to throw him to the dog and get on with someone else.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting. I always make this analogy, and it's interesting. The first thing that happens when you get a crooked judge cornered and he's up for indictment is all the mobsters stay away from him. And the reason they do is they don't want to draw attention to themselves. And the same thing goes on now, I think, with Cheney. We're seeing that the mobsters in our government are staying away from this crooked politician who's now been fingered. And maybe that X is some of the CNN people who are also these mobsters in our government, working as so-called reporters, telling us they're going to throw them to the dogs. Who knows?
And
but
by
that
the
was
way,
interesting.
By the way, Greg, when this X kept flashing, also the text line was reading, Cheney, : I do not believe it is wrong to criticize. That kept flashing with the X.
Wow. And that is so fascinating. How can that, you know, I'm trying to think how that could get by. I mean, it isn't going to be, well, I mean, it could be just a lowly production guy, but he's going to be gone from a job.
He's going to be gone.
I'd like to get to the bottom of that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
And, yeah, you saw that on Rense.com. Jeff Rense, a good friend of mine, he's a talk show host at night, and I'll have to talk to him about that. But interesting stuff, Neela. We have another segment, and I apologize. Every time I try to get to your book, somebody calls. But anyway, we do have a few minutes on the other side of this break. War Paint of the Gods, I want to get into that. So let me take this break. I hear the music playing. So let me take this break, and then we'll come back with Neela, and we'll talk a few minutes about the book you just published called War Paint of the Gods.
on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Hey, back for the last segment. Neela, you got to get into your book, War Paint of the Gods. What inspired you to write it, and where can people get it? Go ahead.
What inspired me was, as I said, Carlos Santana was on TV. He was being interviewed on CNN, and the interviewer asked him, Carlos, what is your religion? And Santana says, you know, if you can tell me God's religion, that is my religion. And this got me thinking. It was a spark of inspiration. But in the book I ask, does God have a religion? And if he does, what is it? And if he does not, why do we human beings have so many? And that's pretty much, and I asked the question, I said, can one love and worship God with all one's heart and soul, yet belong to no religion? So this could be interesting to some people, but I try to present the case that more wars, more bloodshed, has been committed in the name of God than anything else. For instance, the book is peppered with quotes from famous people.
And yeah, go ahead, tell us.
One is Blaise Pascal, and he says, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. You know, it's so true when you think about it. It's religion has stirred up so much hatred, so much anger. Then I have this quote in the preface for Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1979. And during his acceptance speech, he says, quote, with or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. So this is a pretty hard hit on organized religion in all its forms. I don't have a religion. If you ask me what is my religion, I say it's God. I believe in a creative force. People have different names for it. I call him the One. And my son, I have a 14-year-old son, and he's raised the same way. So it's a little confusing to people who don't understand what I'm trying to convey. But my premise is that if you got rid of religions, per se, and simply believed in a creator or God or whatever you wanted to call him, and took away these labels we stick on our foreheads and bumper stickers we hang on our cars, we'd find a far more peaceful planet.
Yeah, I mean, did you touch on George Bush at all and his idea that he is sent from God to get rid of the evildoers?
I allude to him, but I don't use his name because I didn't want to, you know, make an ad hominem attack on the man. But I consider him a pillar of this. I mean, he has a pipeline directed to God. And I also talk about the possibility of intelligence, extraterrestrial intelligence, life forms in other parts of the universe. And I build a very, very strong case for it. I quote astronauts, fighter pilots, former U.S. presidents, and talk of the possibility that the Earth has been visited by beings who are far more intelligent than us that we can't even comprehend. And I build a case using scientific formulas like, you know, the Green Bank formula and various physical theories and possibilities for life in other parts of the cosmos. But the reason I bring that up is to ask the question, if the universe is peppered with life forms elsewhere, I mean, doesn't that make our little earthly, this little intergalactic speck of dust with all its divisive religious forms and all our wars, does it make it sound ridiculous? So it's meant to open people's minds. William Jeans was a very famous British astrophysicist, and he... You know, we talk of our solar system and we talk about our galaxy. In our galaxy alone, and there's some, we've estimated there could be as many as 20 billion intelligent life forms. 20 billion. This was done at the Green Bank Observatory and is now called the Green Bank Formula.
I wish one of them would come down and just take Bush and his group away to some other planet.
Well, would that be nice? You know, what I'd like to see is to have Bush and the rest of these maniacs incarcerated, tried at The Hague, and incarcerated for life, because
that's a good ending for this show, Neela. I was fascinated. Where can people get your book real quick? We got about 20 seconds.
They can get it on Amazon.com. Just put in War Paint of the Gods, or go to any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, any one of these places, and order it, as you might find it on the shelf. If you don't, you can always order it through them. War Paint of the Gods.
Okay, Neela, thank you very much. A fascinating show, a lot of interest. We'll have you back again sometime.
Thank you, Greg.
I will see you tomorrow on the Investigative Journal on the Republic Broadcasting Network.